little bit happy to start your Aloha Friday. Good morning. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Beth Ann. NPR News just referred to a new chapter in U.S.-Cuba relations, and it's a chapter nobody's read yet, right?
Well, that's true, and it's one that we're not quite sure may happen in exactly the way that perhaps the president envisions, but it's certainly worth talking about. Now, you know that for over 50 years, the relationship between the U.S. and Cuba could be described with many words. Normal might not be one of them. This week, as you know, President Obama announced that he intends to open formal diplomatic ties with Cuba. That's drawing two opposite reactions and not much of either based on current firsthand knowledge, according to HPU Assistant Professor Aisha Nibi. Her academic interests aside, she has significant personal ties to the island, which puts her in regular contact with daily life in Cuba. She's made two extensive visits in 2009 and last year. And she joins us this morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
How did you come to be so deeply involved with Cuba?
So actually, I'm an anthropologist, and my field site is in northern Uganda. And so while I was doing my field research for my PhD, I met a Cuban in northern Uganda and became friends with him. And over the course of the next couple years, I ended up becoming pretty close to the Cuban community in Uganda. And I came to understand that the Cuban government has a program of Cuban internationalism in which one of the things they do is they send doctors and professors and sports professionals overseas to basically fill in gaps in these countries in Latin America, in Africa, and other places. So I became close with the Cuban community in Uganda, and in the course of those relationships, I ended up sending my research assistant from Uganda to Cuba to study, because one of the other aspects of Cuban internationalism is that the Cuban government provides scholarships for students from Africa and Latin America and Asia to go to Cuba to study. And so I sent two kids from Uganda to Cuba to study, and they were both war orphans. And so I was kind of their mom through college. And so I was responsible to meet their needs outside of the tuition and, you know, the roof over their head. So in the course of that process over the last 6 years, I ended up being in very close contact and knowing, you know, every time a hurricane happens or any kind of political issues happen or, you know, changes in policies between the U.S. and Cuba, that would affect my ability to take care of them. So, you know, I became really kind of deeply attuned to the goings on, you know, on the island.
And going there several times to have to take care of some of those issues.
Exactly.
So as you've had so much contact with them and recent contact, you were there last year, how is it that some of this has not sort of percolated through American consciousness, some of the things that Cuba has been doing, and that we seem to have very polarized ideas of Cuba that for a lot of people are based in history from over 50 years ago?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that on both sides, both U.S. and Cuba sides, the government of Cuba and the, you know, U.S. media tends to tell certain stories about each other. And but I was surprised, actually, when I was in Africa to see the way that Fidel Castro was characterized by the African media. They saw him as a hero in a lot of ways. And as you may remember, at Nelson Mandela's funeral, Raul Castro gave a speech along with Obama. Yeah. Cuba was a big supporter of the anti-apartheid movement. So Cuba is seen in a lot of parts of the world as a sort of hero nation that stood up to U.S. imperialism. But, you know, so, yeah.
But that idea doesn't necessarily translate to how some expatriate Cubans living in Miami feel about their former country. Why are they still so angry? And is that breaking down on generational lines?
So, yeah, I mean, when the revolution happened in 1959, basically, you know, a lot of industries were nationalized, and U.S. Corporate interests were kicked out. And so a lot of people lost privilege and wealth in that process. And, you know, if you know, we're middle class, and if we lost some of those privileges, we might also be upset about that. But on top of that, there were, you know, if you were seen as a political threat, there absolutely were violations of human rights during that process.
People were killed.
People were killed. They were arrested. And in that sense, I fully understand the sentiments of Miami Cubans. That history is hard to get over.
But that's an older generation that seems to be coming back with that kind of anger. It seems that from having heard what some younger Cubans are saying, they're almost at the point of saying, okay, enough already. It's time to normalize those relationships. Would that be true from what you've seen the people you talk to?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the youngest of the exiles when they came from Cuba are now senior citizens. And so, for the younger generation in Miami, they are Americans and they are involved in the national discussions that we have here. I'm not saying they're not affected by discussions, you know, related to Cuba, and they are deeply connected with the island, but not in the way that their parents and grandparents were.
But they are certainly very connected to the idea of having political prisoners exchanged for the possibility of having now a full diplomatic mission in Cuba.
Sure. I mean, I think if anything, the younger generations in Cuba want to be able to go there freely and establish their relationships on the island and have a little more freedom in that respect, and also help their families in it, you know, more easily. It's been incredibly difficult to send goods or money or things like that there. So, yeah.
We have just a minute left to talk, but as you look at the prospect of having full diplomatic ties to Cuba after all of these years of not and generations that have come and are going, this process is not a slam dunk by any means.
No, it's going to take some time to implement. In order for the internet to operate on the island, they'll need to install fiber optic cables. The bank infrastructure, in order for the banks to articulate with U.S. banks, it's going to take time to set that up. It might take up to a year.
And it's going to have to be able to go through the American government.
Well, this stuff, the bank, all the stuff I've just mentioned is you know, approved now under the executive order. But there are other, essentially the embargo is kind of a shell of what it was before. So it is a sweeping sort of change. But the final change in terms of our full freedom to go to the island, to go to Cuba, that will have to happen with the approval of Congress.
Just to be able to whip out a credit card is going to take some doing.
Yes.
All right. Aisha, thank you for coming in. Aisha Nibe is an assistant professor of anthropology at Hawaii Pacific University. She's an associate scholar and member of the advisory board of the University of California Cuba Academic Initiative. That's an academic consortium of scholars who conduct research on Cuba. She's also the author of a chapter on Cuban internationalism in health travels, Cuban healthcare on and off island.